From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talked to Todd Solondz, writer and director of Welcome to the Dollhouse, Happiness, and the new film Storytelling. He has a sense of humor that some viewers think is kind of sick, and others think is very original and perceptive. And we'll meet Paul Giamatti, who plays a documentary filmmaker in Storytelling. He's best known for his role as the NBC executive in the Howard Stern movie Private Parts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Attorney General John Ashcroft announced a federal grand jury indictment today against the American accused of fighting alongside the Taliban in Afghanistan. The 10-count indictment says John Walker Lind conspired to kill Americans and provided support to terrorist organizations. Ashcroft said the indictment describes the 20-year-old Californian as an al-Qaeda-trained terrorist who conspired with the Taliban to kill his fellow citizens. Lind is scheduled for a court appearance in Virginia tomorrow. Congress continues to probe the aftermath of the Enron collapse. Today, a Senate committee voted to subpoena the company's former CEO, Kenneth Lay. NPR's Peter Overby reports from the Capitol.
The vote by the Senate Commerce Committee was unanimous. The House Financial Services Committee is also issuing a subpoena for Lay, who was once a big supporter of President Bush. Joe Berardino, head of Enron's former auditing firm, Arthur Andersen, did testify at a financial services hearing. Berardino professed ignorance about details of the Enron audits. New York Democrat Gary Ackerman responded.
And I'm finding it very difficult to believe that a person who has risen to a position of such prominence and importance in the financial community can present himself as knowing absolutely nothing about what's going on in his own business. And maybe it's better to be dumb than culpable.
Lawmakers were more sympathetic to Berardino's proposals for reforming auditing rules. Peter Overby, NPR News, the Capitol.
Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle says he'll pull an economic stimulus bill from consideration tomorrow. The South Dakota Democrat said neither Democrats nor Republicans have enough votes to win approval for their competing versions of the bill. President Bush was in Pittsburgh today promoting his budget proposal and discussing homeland security. Mark Neutbar reports from member station WDUQ.
President Bush met with researchers in Pittsburgh who are developing a health monitoring system that helps to spot disease outbreaks, even if the victims are spread over a large area. Since 1999, when it was first implemented, the system has detected little more than flu outbreaks. But Mr. Bush says communication systems nationwide need to be improved.
So that there's real-time communications, so that we can share information in a crisis. Information sharing will help save lives. And so part of the money is to bring our systems up to speed, to make them more modern and more responsive.
The president is asking for a more than 300% increase in homeland defense spending. He says the money spent on research and early detection will have benefits beyond the fight against terrorism, improving overall public health. For NPR News, I'm Mark Neutbar in Pittsburgh.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 2 points to close at 9,685 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 17 points to close at 1,838. The S&P 500 lost 4 points. This is NPR News. House Republican leaders have agreed to allow a debate and a vote next week on campaign finance reform. The Shays-Meehan bill would ban so-called soft money, the unregulated donations that are made directly to political parties. It would also ban certain types of political advertising by unions, corporations, and some special interest groups within 60 days of an election. The bill has the support of most Democrats, but it's opposed by many Republicans who say it limits free speech. Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig has called off plans to eliminate two major league teams this year. Michael Koo reports from Minnesota Public Radio.
Baseball owners have faced a string of legal challenges since they announced contraction plans last November. In postponing those efforts, Selig cited a recent ruling by the Minnesota Supreme Court that effectively forces the Minnesota Twins to honor the final year of their lease and play the 2002 season in Minneapolis's Metrodome. The Twins were considered a top candidate for elimination. Major League Baseball also faced a challenge from the Players Union, which considered the move a violation of baseball's labor agreement. Selig says, however, that the contraction issue will return next year. He says removing two teams is necessary to stem millions of dollars of losses by baseball owners. The Twins and the Montreal Expos generated the least amount of revenue in 2001. For NPR News, I'm Michael Ku in St. Paul.
Bell South has announced plans to lay off about 700 more employees. The job cuts come on top of the 2,000 workers who've been let go in the past 4 months. The big regional phone company says the latest cuts are part of a consolidation plan that eliminates some of its call centers. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Bill Moyers, who reports on NAFTA's effect on American rights, on Trading Democracy, tonight at 10 on PBS. Local times may vary.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, screenwriter and director Todd Solondz, has a strange sense of humor. He zeroes in on the kinks, malfunctions, and extremes of people's personalities. Some viewers found his 1998 movie Happiness in bad taste because the characters included a pedophile and someone obsessed with phone sex. But others thought he used these extremes to create a funny and perceptive take on the anxieties of modern life. His previous comedy, Welcome to the Dollhouse, was about the least popular girl in junior high, Dawn Wiener. His new movie, Storytelling, is told in two separate parts. The first part begins with a college student, Marcus, who's an aspiring writer but is very insecure about his work. He has cerebral palsy and has just written a short story based on his relationship with his girlfriend. He reads it in class and is critiqued first by his fellow students, then by his Pulitzer Prize-winning professor.
I thought that was really good, Marcus. Really moving and emotional.
Yeah, I thought it was really emotional, too.
And, I mean, really good word choices. It kind of reminded me a little of Faulkner, but East Coast and disabled.
Or Flannery O'Connor. She had multiple sclerosis.
And Borges, he was blind.
Updike has psoriasis.
Maybe I'm wrong. But I'm afraid I found the whole thing to be a little trite. Its earnestness is, well, it's a little embarrassing. And those adjectives are flat-footed and redundant. I'm sorry. I mean, anyway, don't. What do I know? Don't even listen to what I say. I mean.
Anyone else? Catherine is right. The story's a piece of You express nothing but banalities, and, formally speaking, are unable to construct a single compelling sentence. You ride on a wave of clichés so worn, in fact, it actually approaches the level of grotesquerie. And your subtitle, The Rawness of Truth. Is this supposed to be a joke of some sort? Or are you just being pretentious?
A scene from the new movie Storytelling. When we first meet Marcus, he's passionately making love to his girlfriend. Only after do we find out he has cerebral palsy. I asked writer and director Todd Solondz about creating this character.
The last thing you want is to have a character defined by his affliction. I had actually auditioned a number of people with cerebral palsy for the role, but decided at the end that the best actor I could find would be someone who would have to learn to mimic a degree of this affliction. If you don't have a cerebral palsy, then the natural response is to feel for this person. And yet, of course, this person doesn't want to be reduced to, of course, just someone with cerebral palsy. It cheats him of the right to be admired on the one hand for who he is as a person, or on the other hand, to be condemned for who he is as a person and should be, I think, respected or not on the same basis as everyone else.
In your movies, you've created a lot of characters who are very depressed, very alienated, also very self-delusional. In your movie Welcome to the Dollhouse, the junior high school student at the center of the movie suffers every insult and indignity, from being taunted in the cafeteria to being threatened with rape at knife point. You grew up in suburban New Jersey. What were your school experiences like? Was that a difficult period for you going to school?
Well, it had its high points and its low points. I went to many different schools. I attended an Orthodox yeshiva. I attended a public school and attended also a progressive experimental school. And then I went to an all-boys prep school.
Wow, so, that's really so 360 degrees of schooling.
Yeah, so I kind of covered the gamut there. And I wanted, when I made Welcome to the Dollhouse, to make it a general public school, junior high school experience. I'm not sure, actually, I forgot what the question was.
It was about your school experiences, but I'm wondering whether people, say, for instance, at the Orthodox yeshiva, any kinder or less cruel than students in public school or prep school, yeah.
Well, I do think that, of course, certain kinds of schools and certain kinds of teachers know how to handle the difficulties of growing up better than others. But there is inherence in all of us, and we are not quite so far removed from the childhood years as I think we like to believe sometimes, which is why I often explore or often have characters that are 11 years old. I can remember when I was 11 years old, and I remembered much preferring the company of adults and not quite understanding why they didn't look at me as one of their peers.
When I've read that you started writing stories when you were a kid. Did you write stories that expressed the kind of unhappiness and alienation that your movies express? Because I was thinking, if your stories as a child did express that, you'd be likely to have been taken to, like, a psychologist or a psychiatrist after the adults in your life read the stories.
Well, I wasn't taken to a psychologist or a social worker as a child, and no, after making my movies, I haven't been taken to a psychiatrist either. But as a child, I all I can say is I wrote a lot. I don't know why, but I loved writing, and it's a time of life when. I certainly never thought of the audience or of how I was manipulating or managing or guiding the audience. It was all a kind of a self-absorbed wonderland. I suppose I could look at it now. I still have some of these stories and so forth that I had written. I remember I had a continuing novel in progress at the time. Every week I would write another chapter and have my father's secretary would type it up for me. And it was a way of life at that time. There was a wonderful beauty to the process of writing at the age of 11 that I think I will never be able to retrieve. This a kind of purity, something that I will always strive to attain, but I don't think it's quite possible for me as an adult.
Now, you've taken the kind of alienation and discomfort that you write about and turned it into comedy, into a very kind of strange, eccentric form of comedy, but it's often comedy. And I'm wondering why comedy. And I ask that, I mean, for some people, comedy is just, it's where they live, you know what I mean? But it's not like you're being very funny or ironic in your approach to explaining things now. So does comedy feel like the natural place that you want to write in, or is it a more conscious thing that you're doing when you write comedy?
Well, I think that my work is certainly reflective of how I see the world and how I experience it in some sense. What I find to be funny, I am often very moved by, and vice versa, that there is a connection between the two, and that if I'm not really moved, I probably won't find it very funny. My movies are comedies, emphatically comedies. They may be terribly sad and sorrowful and painful, but comedies nevertheless. And this is, I think, what may not sit well with many people, that I, in fact, do look at them in this way. But without this level of detachment that the comedy or irony, what have you, provides, I think that the material would be unbearable. I don't know that I'd be able to sit through it otherwise.
I want to talk about a scene that I think perfectly combines what you're talking about in terms of it being both very funny and very moving at the same time. There's a scene in Happiness where the son, who's, I don't know, he's probably around 13 or something, comes
11.
11, okay, yeah, 11, that magic age.
Yes.
He's 11. He goes to his father, and I should mention here that his father is a pedophile, which, of course, the son doesn't know. So the son goes to the father, and he's really troubled, and he says, basically tells his father that he's uncomfortable about his penis. He's not sure if it's the right size. He's not sure it works right. He's not sure it works like the other kids, you know, have theirs work. And he's obviously really upset. He's really self-conscious. He's really uncomfortable, and he thinks there's something terribly wrong with him. And the father, who's actually a pedophile, has to, like, comfort his son and kind of explain the facts of life a little bit. And at the same time, this kind of really syrupy music is coming up in the background, the kind of music you'd expect in the heart-to-heart talk in an afternoon soap. So the scene is operating on two levels at the same time, at least two levels. On the one hand, it really is kind of moving because this kid is really uncomfortable about something that makes everybody uncomfortable when they're young, and he needs some advice. And at the same time, it's really funny because the father, who really wants to help the kid, is also a pedophile. Why don't you talk about writing that scene? Because it's typical of the kind of scene that some viewers would probably find really kind of sick and upsetting, in part because the father is a pedophile.
Well, yes, there is something of a tightrope, I suppose, as you may have put it, that I walk here. You try to be truthful to the reality that you set up. Otherwise, I think it'll all just feel cheap and false and not really have any meaning that can stick. When I write a scene, I, in a sense, become an actor. I become the kid. I become the father. And I try to imagine myself in both characters' shoes and how each person would feel and what's on that person's mind, what they want, and how they manage to communicate with each other. The point always is to make it fresh so that it doesn't, on the one hand, feel like you've seen it already, and yet on the other hand, doesn't feel gratuitous or just out to shock you for the sake of shocking you. It has to feel real and in the moment.
I think part of what makes the scene funny too is that you've taken this real father knows best type of setting and put in the kind of subject matter that kids really worry about that would never be on Father Knows Best. And also, you've taken, you know, you talked about not wanting something false, but you've intentionally used that kind of false sentimental music as a backdrop to that scene.
Well, there's a commentary, of course, with the music to give the sense of that this is the kind of family you might see on the Lifetime channel, that it's like a family that you might see on TV, but of course you won't, not on network TV, at least.
My guest is Todd Solondz, screenwriter and director of Welcome to the Dollhouse, Happiness, and the new film Storytelling. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Todd Solondz, screenwriter and director of Welcome to the Dollhouse, Happiness, and the new film Storytelling. You create characters who are often very disturbing, particularly in Happiness. You know, one character is a pedophile, one character is a phone sex, you know, someone who calls up strangers to engage them in phone sex. Everybody in the movie is self-delusional about something. You know, there's one of the sisters in the movie is a popular writer of transgressive S&M fiction. And she worries that she's not authentic because she writes about rape, but she's never been raped. And maybe if she was raped, then she could be authentic. So everybody's just a little bizarre in this. At the same time, I think you've written the characters with so much sympathy, even though they're very comedic, that it's almost as if you're playing out everybody's worst fear about themselves, kind of blowing out of proportion everybody's fears about their own fantasies or their own feelings that make them uncomfortable and have them embodied in these other characters.
Well, I appreciate your saying that. I sometimes... people look at my movies and will say to me, why do you make movies about such ugly characters? And well, I say, well, they're not ugly to me. The people may not be conventionally beautiful, so to speak, but it's not only in spite of their flaws, but in part because of their flaws that I can more fully embrace them as human. And it doesn't mean, for example, that you have to sympathize exactly with certainly what Bill Maplewood has done is unequivocally unforgivable. I don't think there's any doubt about
that. The pedophile character.
Yes, yes. Nevertheless, to be able to recognize him as human and not just the demon seed, I think accords oneself, I think, a greater level of humanity. And, of course, it's much easier if you want to create sympathetic characters. It's the easiest thing in the world. You know, you give them cancer, and, of course, your heart will go out to the person. But that's not a very challenging way of working, let's say, for me as a filmmaker. What I am most compelled by is getting into the minds and to getting into subjects in ways that I think may force us to reevaluate our perceptions about not only other people, but ourselves.
Well, have you ever had people make assumptions about you that you found upsetting?
Let me say this. If someone doesn't like what I do, if they hate the movie, I don't have a problem with that. But occasionally there will be a journalist who will say something of a personal nature that, of course, I will take offense at. But most people are not like that. I remember back when Welcome to the Dollhouse was being received, often very favorably. Nevertheless, some journalists would describe Heather Matarazzo or myself physically in very unflattering terms. And I couldn't help wondering how that the irony seemed to elude these journalists, that they, in fact, became the seventh graders in that movie. To describe this 11-year-old girl as an ugly girl, I just can't understand how anyone would write that and how one can possibly write that and feel good about oneself.
It sounds like when you were young, you weren't a very social person. You liked to stay home alone. And when you make movies, you kind of have to be a social person in a way, not necessarily going to parties, but being on the set with a lot of people, engaging with actors in a way that they're willing to still work with you. Do you think that you've been changed by the act of making movies?
It's true. I think that my character really isn't designed well for being a director on a set. I don't really enjoy the position. I don't get much pleasure out of all the power that I'm accorded. I get no adrenaline high from this. All I dream about while I'm on set is being back home again. It's an assaultive process, and one in which you simply don't have the absolute control, far from it, that you have as a writer when you're working alone in your room. Nevertheless, if someone's going to screw it up, I'd rather it be me than someone else. So I take on the job. On the other hand, I have to say, you know, it's part of the dilemma, part of the reality of being the filmmaker I am, at least, is that I find that when I am writing alone, my fantasy, of course, is being out there on set, anything but being alone in this room.
I want to ask you about one scene in your new movie, Storytelling. There's a sex scene in which you obscure the sex act that's going on by just taking an orange rectangle and covering the actual coupling with the rectangle. did you actually shoot the scene as a sex scene and then cover it up?
Here's what happened, and it's really it's more of a Soviet red, I believe, than an orange.
Okay.
In order to make this movie, I needed a certain amount of money that only New Line was going to provide. That's the studio that financed it, finally. So it was either make the movie with New Line or not make it. I knew that New Line would not be able to release a movie that was not R-rated or PG-13. They will not release NC-17 movies. And I knew I had a scene in it that was a little bit troublesome. So I put in the contract, and negotiated in the contract, the ability to put beeps and or bars as necessary, as need be, in order to procure the R rating if there would be a problem. I've always felt good about this, that in any movie, that if there was going to be a problem with the ratings, I always wanted there to be, I'd rather there be a big red box covering something up, or a beep covering up a line, than to having something removed. So for me, this is very much a victory to be able to put this red box over that shot rather than having the shot removed. I didn't want to have to redesign the movie to appease the needs of the ratings board. Of course, when the film was finished and we did have that big red box there, the head of the studio saw it and he said, "Over my dead body, you're not putting a big red box in this movie." But because I had negotiated at the get-go the ability to do that, the contract was respected, and this will be the first studio movie released with a big red box in the middle of it. I'm very proud, and I think that it actually adds a layer of meaning, I think, to the film. It does make it more overtly political in a way that I had never imagined it would be.
Well, Todd Solondz, I really want to thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Todd Solondz wrote and directed Welcome to the Dollhouse, Happiness, and Storytelling. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Henry and Edith Everett, recognizing Teach for America, college graduates teaching in under-resourced public schools. 800-TFA-1230. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Paul Giamatti, one of the stars of Todd Solondz's new film, Storytelling. Giamatti played the role of the NBC executive in Howard Stern's film, Private Parts.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Paul Giamatti, is one of the stars of Storytelling, the new movie written and directed by Todd Solondz, who we heard from in the first half of the show. Giamatti is best known for his role as an NBC executive in the Howard Stern movie Private Parts. He's also been in Saving Private Ryan, The Negotiator, Man on the Moon, The Truman Show, Mighty Aphrodite, and the recent remake of Planet of the Apes. He's the son of the late A. Bartlett Giamatti, who was a president of Yale University and served as baseball commissioner. In the new film Storytelling, Paul Giamatti plays Toby Oxman, who wants to make movies and hopes to start by making a documentary about a high school. We first meet him in this scene. He's sitting on his bed next to his high school yearbook, calling someone from his past.
I'm a documentary filmmaker.
Oh, anything I might have seen?
Not yet. I'm hoping to get a grant for this one project on teenagers. Jeez, you remember when we were teenagers?
Yeah, you didn't want to take me to the prom.
Oh, I don't remember that.
I do.
Well, but it was so long ago. We were so different back then. I'm looking for subjects for this documentary on teenage life in suburbia. It's kind of an exploration of the psyche, of its mythology. I wrote to Derrida to see if he'd like to do the narration, but everything's still kind of in development at this point.
Huh.
I work in a shoe store right now. But it's cool. I'm not ashamed. I mean, I have a much stronger sense of self now. And anyway, it's really very temporary.
That's good.
Yeah. So anyway, tell me, what about you? I'd heard through the grapevine that you were producing movies.
Yeah, but not anymore.
Tired of life in the fast lane? Yeah. So, you're, married?
Yeah.
Huh. Kids?
Yeah.
Paul Giamatti, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
I'd like you to describe in your own words your part in Storytelling.
Well, I play a guy named Toby Oxman, who is a bit of a failure at everything he's put his hand to, and he's decided he's going to try and be a documentary filmmaker. And he decides that he's going to make a film about a young suburban high school kid in New Jersey and his family. That's basically who he is. And the film doesn't work out necessarily in a great way for the family.
Yeah, you mean well when you start out making the movie.
I think the guy entirely means well. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, his intentions are only good.
What goes wrong?
Well, pretty much everything. I mean, it goes as cataclysmically wrong as it possibly could. I mean, he's a guy who probably doesn't have a whole lot of talent for what he's doing. I mean, he's sort of deciding to do this because a lot of other things haven't worked out. And he intends to start out just exploring these people's lives and presenting them just as plainly as he can. And I think he ends up exploiting these people and. The movie ends up being something that people look at and laugh at and see sort of comically, and these people, he ends up sort of condescending to these people and turning them into figures of fun.
Now, Todd Solondz's movies aren't exactly realism. His movies like Welcome to the Dollhouse, Happiness, and now Storytelling, they're comedies where character flaws, problems, their alienation, the character's delusions, is heightened in a very comic and also very perceptive way. Mm-hmm. How did he direct you in this role? What kind of direction did he give?
That's one of the most interesting things about it is that they're not realistic. I mean, these characters are types for the most part. You know, they're not caricatures and they're not stereotypes, but they are sort of recognizable characters. So they're not entirely realistic. And that is one of the tricky things about doing his stuff. I mean, one of the tricky things about doing this character was that the guy speaks almost entirely in very kind of shop-worn cliches. I mean, he speaks in very sort of bland, not particularly deeply thought out ways. So it's tricky to ground it in something real is very tricky. How he manages to do that is mysterious. I mean, he's very specific about how he wants you to play moments, and I think that keeps it grounded in some kind of reality. It's very slippery stuff. One of the things that was enjoyable about doing it was that it was challenging stuff to do.
Now, Todd Solondz seems like a pretty eccentric person. What was it like to work with him?
He seems like an eccentric guy. He's not necessarily a hugely eccentric guy. He's a lot less so than you think he's going to be from his stuff. You expect this kind of grotesque, bizarre guy, but he's actually very very soft-spoken, very clear about what he wants to do. He's a very funny guy, very approachable guy. He keeps the mood on the set very light. So it's funny because there's definitely a disjunction between his stuff and then who he is when you meet him. He doesn't seem to be anywhere near as weird as the stuff that he writes.
How did you get the part in storytelling?
Just the sort of normal channels. I mean, my agent gets a script, and I think he was interested in using me. I'd met him on Happiness and had the worst audition I think I've ever had for somebody. So I guess he was interested in bringing me in again, which was surprising and nice. And so I went in and met him, and I auditioned for it and got the part. And he works with you a lot in the auditions, which is the most work you do on the character with him is in the auditions.
What went wrong in your first audition with him for Happiness?
Well, I think it was that thing of, like I say, I find his stuff slippery. It's tricky. It's very, the language is very, it's not, it's very sedate. It's very, it's kind of colorless in a way on the page. And I am an actor for whom restraint is a challenging thing. So I found it hard to fit myself into his mode, which is low key. So I think I was overacting, basically, is what I'm saying, like crazy in this thing. And it doesn't work. His stuff falls apart if you don't keep it in that kind of tense, restrained place that he's writing from.
What kind of roles do you think you're thought of for? Is there like a Paul Giamatti role?
Well, I guess I would say, I mean, I seem to play guys who are not, I never seem to play the out-and-out bad guy, and I certainly never play the good guy. I seem to play sort of the muddled, confused, vaguely pathetic guys. I mean, it seems like it. I mean, within that, I seem to play a range of guys. I mean, I can play very aggressive, pathetic guys. But, I mean, definitely in more so, it happens to me in movies, I think, that I'm thought of for the same sorts of things. Sort of tense guys, failures, a lot of failures, a lot of guys who are not, just missing the brass ring, these guys. They're reaching for it, but they just miss it constantly. So those kinds of guys, it seems like.
And why do you think you get those roles?
I don't know. It's not just because they're coming to me with them. I mean, I'm definitely interested in them. I mean, I think I definitely find failure an interesting thing to play out. I mean, I think I find it's challenging. I mean, playing weak people is interesting to me. I mean, I don't know whether it's that I see people, I just tend to see the weaknesses in people, and that interests me or something. I don't know.
My guest is actor Paul Giamatti. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. My guest is actor Paul Giamatti. He's now starring in the new Todd Solondz movie, Storytelling. Now, I think the role you're probably best known for is your role in the Howard Stern movie, Private Parts, in which you play the NBC programming executive who Stern nicknames Pig Vomit. And your most famous scene is the scene when you first meet Howard Stern, in which you're trying to explain to him that it's really important to say the call letters the right way. So let me play that scene. This is your first meeting with Howard Stern at the NBC studios in New York.
Oh, Howard. Howard, the way we work here at NBC is a more professional manner than you're probably used to. Now, see, I don't care about what you did down in Washington, because that's chicken radio. Here at NBC, this is real radio. And the first thing you've got to do is say the call letters properly. Okay? Now, I'm going to teach you how to say them. All right? And, you know, I hope you can get them. Because, see, you don't have a real good voice like I'm as Captain Frank or nothing. So we're going to have to practice it.
Well, you mean practicing here now?
You're not going to get bashful on me now, are you, Howard? Okay, you ready? The way it's said properly is WNBC. This is key. Come on.
WNBC.
No, no. Got to be more like this. Listen up. WNBC. You hear that kind of lift? The NBC.
WNBC. WNBC.
Wider.
WNBC.
One more.
In my mind, I'm hearing, it sounds like I'm saying exactly what you're saying.
No, actually.
WNBC.
You know what? You got to listen to Imus. Imus does it perfectly. Tell you what, I'm going to take you down to Imus's office right now, and you're going to hear how he does it. Come on, boy.
Okay, did your way of saying NBC get repeated back at you forever and ever by Howard Stern fans after this movie?
Yes, it happens a lot that people say that to me and people want me to say it. I'm always having people in airports come up to me and wanting me to say that, yeah.
And what do you do? Do you oblige them? Are you a nice guy about it or what?
Well, yeah, you know, I try to be a nice guy about it. I've gotten nicer about it. At first, I didn't want to do it. I felt put upon by people. I actually felt most put upon if I had to do an interview and somebody asked me to do it. I always felt sort of like, I mean, I didn't mind it so much if, you know, somebody on the bus saying, you know, could you say that for me? I would do it. I felt like, you know, somebody asking me to do it in an interview, it felt, I don't know, kind of silly, and I was being asked to be a little bit of a performing seal. But actually, I don't know why lately I haven't minded doing it so much. Yeah, but it does happen a lot.
Now, this is the role of somebody who thinks he's really smart, who thinks he's got a lot of power, but he's just being made fun of and made to look weak all the time by Howard Stern. So can you talk a little bit about playing that part?
That was like you say, what was fun about that was this guy has this sense of enormous power that he's just, you know, he's going to break Howard Stern, and that was fun. I remember in playing that part, the key thing with that part I remember was I really wanted to have a big old chunky college ring on, like one of those with the big, you know, the big chunky bronze colored thing with the big blue gem in the middle. And because I thought this was the kind of guy who was you know, he could never be on the football team, but he hung out with the jocks. And this was the kind of guy he hung out in the big jockey frat, but he was a knucklehead, and he was never, never the guy that he thought he was. You know, he always styled himself. And, you know, when he ran the college radio station, and he was very, you know, for some reason that ring was, like, really key to a guy who kind of, he imagined himself being such a kind of bigger, much more kind of macho guy than he actually was. So that ring became really essential to me, and I had to hunt one down, and that really was important for me, that ring.
Where'd you get the ring?
I don't know, some weird little costume jewelry place down the Lower East Side somewhere. You know, it was just a fake one. But, I really, that was a key thing. And also, I remember, that was interesting because it was the first time I'd done something a part that big, and it was the first time I'd done something that comical on film. And it was fun doing that with because I thought, oh, this is going to be tricky. There's no audience. I won't have a laugh coming. But what became great about that was I forgot it was supposed to be funny, and I just played it actually as straight as I could in a way. So it became fun just not having to worry about being funny and just totally investing in this guy's sense of his own self and power. It was fun.
Had you listened to Howard Stern on the radio before doing the movie with him?
Not that much. Occasionally I had. But I was not like a big fan or anything like that. I was not, I mean, I liked it when I heard it, but I had not really listened to it much.
Of course, everyone who's heard the show would want to know, is he as obnoxious in person as he could be on the radio?
He's not at all obnoxious. It was amazing. He was almost weirdly friendly and sort of low-key and very polite. And he was actually a real pleasure to work with. One of the most pleasurable experiences I've had. He was, he's not obnoxious at all. He's a very, very friendly guy, very hardworking, playful guy.
Were you ever a guest on his show?
I think I did a phone-in one time when I was out in Los Angeles. It was like, it was 4 o'clock in the morning where I was, and I called in. But I was very wary about doing his show, and I still am, because I'm just, I don't know what he's going to do.
Exactly. Was it like a different person on the radio than he was in person?
Yeah, he does seem like a different person in some ways. I mean, it definitely, he changes in some way. And I don't think I could handle being, having weird curveballs thrown at me. I don't think I'd be very good at it.
My guest is actor Paul Giamatti. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Paul Giamatti. He's one of the stars of the new Todd Solondz movie, Storytelling. He was also in Private Parts, The Negotiator, The Truman Show, and the recent remake of Planet of the Apes. Let me ask you about another part. You were in Saving Private Ryan. Describe your role in that.
I played a guy. Well, that's true. I don't think I even remember the name of the guy I played. I think he had a name. I played a paratrooper sergeant. I don't know if he had a name. I think that was kind of a part where there wasn't much of a part there. I mean, I've had to do that a couple of times where, I've gone in on something and they've said, well, gee, you're not really right for anything, but we'd like you to be in this movie. That's what happened with that. And they were like, well, we kind of want to have this character in this scene who guides Tom Hanks around, and he's a paratrooper sergeant, and we don't really know what we want him to do. But so I play a guy, paratrooper sergeant who takes Tom Hanks to the wrong Private Ryan, and it developed as we did it that I was a little inept. I fell over a lot, and I sort of fell through a brick wall, and I was really kind of not the most competent member of the U.S. Armed Forces.
Is that something that you put into the story or that was written in for you?
It started to develop that way is what happened. I mean, it was, I just kept falling over. I kept stumbling all the time because I was wearing all that equipment was real stuff and it was heavy. And I'm not a very well-coordinated guy. And I wouldn't make much of a soldier. And I was slipping and falling all over the place. And so this became, the director thought, this is interesting. This is good. So they sort of threw in stuff where I was sort of bitching about my ankles were killing me and my back is killing me. And I just became a kind of sad sack loser soldier. So it was fun the way that developed because there really wasn't a part there. I don't, as I remember, there really wasn't much to do.
So you were the kvetch of Saving Private Ryan.
I was the kvetch of Saving Private Ryan, exactly. Very proud moment for me. It was a fun movie to do.
Now, you were in Planet of the Apes. Which ape were you?
I was the kvetch of Planet of the Apes. I was the Borscht Belt orangutan. I was Limbo.
What costume did you have to wear?
I had to wear an orangutan costume.
I mean, describe it. What was it like to be in it?
I had to wear a very elaborate, full prosthetic covering my entire head, rubber, some kind of foam, very light foam latex. And I had to wear rubber gloves and enormous rubber feet. And I had a large belly, like orangutans do. They have these kind of big pendulous bellies. And so I wore this very beautiful, elaborate rubber mask, basically.
Is it any fun to be in a costume movie like that?
Yeah. I it's the kind of thing that I've always wanted to do. I mean, it's the kind of thing when I was a kid. I mean, for me, the things that really excited me about acting when I was a kid, sort of pretending, and the things that really got me going when I was a kid were all the sort of old Universal horror movies, all the sort of Wolfman and, Frankenstein, the Creature from the Black Lagoon, and all that kind of stuff. So this was my opportunity to, you know, to do that kind of thing, and I enjoyed the heck out of it. It was really fun, and it was fun to completely disappear. It's something where you really can't see who it is really fun too.
Where did you see those horror movies? When I was growing up, they were on TV all the time, but that was in the 50s and 60s, and you're younger than that, and I think by the time you were growing up, they weren't on TV all the time.
No, they were still on TV. In the early 70s, they were still on TV. They still had this sort of creature feature. You know, there was Creature Features and WNEW in New York, and there was Chiller. There was a thing called Chiller, where they would
Chiller
show
Theater?
Those things. Yeah, Chiller Theater, and it was on Channel 11, and in New York. So they definitely showed them. They showed all of those old Lon Chaney Jr. things. The Indestructible Man was a big one that made a big impression on me as a kid, where they try to electrocute. They put him in the electric chair, and it only energizes him more. And he goes on a rampage. You know, so I loved those things, but they definitely showed them when I was a kid still.
So, is there a kind of role or a kind of movie that you haven't done yet that you really want to do?
I'd like to play a really calm person. I'd like to play a really sort of calm person. I think that would be nice. I've been lucky in that I've gotten to play lots of different things. I mean, I don't know if there's any specific role that I can think of off the top of my head. You know, I haven't in my life gotten as much of a chance to do things like Shakespeare and stuff like that. I would like to do something like that more on stage, I guess. But I really would, actually. I mean, I'm sort of joking, but not entirely. I mean, it would be interesting. It would be challenging for me to play something more low-key. I don't know what that is, but, I mean, something that required my energy to be not so outward would be challenging for me.
You know how you were kidding before that you play the Jewish role in things, like you were the Borscht Belt guy in Planet of the Apes and the Kvetchy guy in Saving Private Ryan. I mean, you're Italian, right?
Yes, this is true. But I don't think I've ever played an Italian.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I can remember going in. I auditioned for something once, and it was an Italian. The role was of an Italian policeman, and he was very sort of, you know, kind of smacking his kid in the back of the head, and it was very sort of, you know, hey, shut up, hey, Joey, sit down, that kind of thing. And I was doing a lot of this stuff, and the guy kept stopping me and going, okay, that's great, try it this way, and then he would go, and don't forget, you're Italian. And then he would sit, back, and I would do it again, and he would say, okay, great, do it like this, and don't forget, you're Italian. And he'd sit back, and I finally said to him, what do you mean, don't forget I'm Italian? Basically, the idea was that I wasn't being enough, sort of like, hey, Joey, shut up. I wasn't doing enough of that for this guy. And I said to the guy, I am Italian. And he went, well, I know, but you're not being Italian. So, I mean, it was there's a lot of that kind of thing. I've never played an Italian, and I don't look Italian. In other words, I don't have dark hair and dark and a dark complexion, so I don't fit the idea of an Italian, I guess. I have played a lot of Jews, actually. I've played lots of Jewish characters.
And why do you think?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Well, Paul Giamatti, thank you so much for talking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Paul Giamatti is one of the stars of the new movie Storytelling. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Lay That Trumpet in Our Hands by Susan Carol McCarthy, a novel set in Florida during the Civil Rights Movement. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Raja Shahadeh, a Palestinian human rights lawyer. He's written a memoir about coming of age in the occupied West Bank. And we talk with Yossi Klein Halevi, the Israeli correspondent for The New Republic. His first book was called Memoirs of a Jewish Extremist. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.